6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before. We bring the sound communication of our tribe.
Well, good afternoon and welcome to A Public Affair. I'm your host today, Molly Stentz, sitting in for John Quinlan, who's out with the flu. Feel better, John? So today on A Public Affair, we're going to be bringing you a conversation on government surveillance, and it's with Edward Snowden. Now, he's not with us here in the studio, but he has, for the first time since revealing thousands of documents which detailed the depth and breadth of government surveillance, he's addressing the public. He wasn't speaking before Congress today, no. Wasn't in front of a court or through lawyers, wasn't at the press club, wasn't really a press conference at all. National Security Agency contractor turned whistleblower Edward Snowden chose a music festival in Austin, Texas to address the public. It's South by Southwest, and where he just wrapped up a panel that was live streamed on the web. He joined the South by Southwest conference via a video stream from Russia, where he currently lives, since he has been in exile for the past almost a year since his revelations came to light. Now, Edward Snowden is responsible in many ways for leaking the documents to the Guardian newspaper and journalist Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras. And he's responsible for letting us all know about the things that the National Security Agency can do in the name of protecting us from terrorism. Here's just a short list of just a few things that the National Security Agency can do. Did you know this? It can track the numbers of both parties on a phone call, as well as the location, time, and duration. This is what's known as metadata. There's been a lot of news coverage about this. It can spy on foreign leaders' cell phones. It can track bank transactions, monitor text messages. It can hack into the UN and their video conferencing system. It can track communication within media organizations that have presences both here in the U.S. and abroad, organizations like Al Jazeera. It can track their communication. It can access your email, your chat history, your web browsing history. It can map your social networks. It can access your smartphone data. I can go on. In fact, there is quite a long list that was compiled by our friends at radio station WNYC in New York in the Brian Lehrer Show. It's up on their website. It's a page long of everything the NSA has the power to do to us. Now, these are the revelations brought forward by whistleblower Edward Snowden. And today, Edward Snowden, just an hour ago, spoke to a crowd at South by Southwest in a panel moderated by two directors of the American Civil Liberties Union, Ben Wisner, the director of their Speech, Privacy, and Technology Project, and one of their technologists, Christopher Segoyan. And today we're going to bring you an excerpt of just what Edward Snowden had to say. Afterward, we'll be discussing this with our very own local experts here with the ACLU, so stay with us for that. So now, here's Edward Snowden, just an hour today, addressing the South by Southwest conference in Austin, Texas.
My name is Ben Wisner. I'm joined by my colleague Chris Segoyan from the ACLU, and maybe we can bring up on screen the main attraction.
Are we Hello, Austin.
All right. The video may be a little bit choppy. Our friend is appearing through 7 proxies, so if the video is a little slow, you're joining us for the event that one member of Congress from the great state of Kansas hoped would not occur. He wrote to the organizers of South by Southwest urging them to rescind the invitation to Mr. Snowden. The letter included this very curious line, the ACLU would surely concede that freedom of expression for Mr. Snowden has declined since he departed American soil. Now, no one disputes that freedom of expression is stronger here than there, but if there's one person for whom that's not true, it's Ed Snowden. If he were here in the United States, he would be in a solitary cell, subject probably to special administrative measures that would prevent him from being able to communicate to the public and participate in the historic debate that he helped launch. So we're really delighted to be here. One more bit of housekeeping. As I'm sure most of you know, you can ask questions for Mr. Snowden on Twitter using the hashtag AskSnowden. Some group of people backstage will decide which of those questions we see here, and we'll try to leave at least, 20 minutes or so for those questions. So as I said, Ed Snowden's revelations and the courageous journalism of people like Bart Gellman, who you just heard, Glenn Greenwald, Laura Poitras, and others, has really launched an extraordinary global debate. But you might think of that debate as occurring over two tracks. There is a debate in Washington, in the halls of power, about law and policy, about what democratic controls we need to rein in NSA spying, that takes place in courts that are considering the legality, the constitutionality of these programs, in the legislature, considering legislation. But there's a very different conversation that you hear in conference rooms in technology companies, particularly among people working on security issues. And those people are talking less about the warrant requirement for metadata and more about why the hell the NSA is systematically undermining common encryption standards that we all use. Why is the NSA targeting telecommunications companies, internet companies, hacking them to try to steal their customer data, basically manufacturing vulnerabilities to poke holes in the communication systems that we all rely on. We're hoping to mostly focus on that latter conversation here. And with that in mind, Ed, if you're with us, maybe you could say a few words about why you chose for some of your first public remarks to speak to the technology community rather than, say, the policy community in Washington.
Well, thank you for the introduction. I would say South by Southwest and the technology community, the people who are in the room in Austin right now, they're the folks who can really fix things, who can enforce our rights through technical standards, even when Congress hasn't yet gotten to the point of creating legislation to protect our rights in the same manner. When we think about what's happened with the NSA over the last decade in the post-9/11 era, the result has been an adversarial internet, a sort of global free fire zone for governments that's nothing that we ever asked for. It's not what we wanted. And it's something we need to protect against. When we think about the policies that have been advanced, the sort of erosion of Fourth Amendment protections, the proactive seizure of communications, there's a policy response that needs to occur. But there's also a technical response that needs to occur. And it's the makers, it's the thinkers, it's the development community that can really craft those solutions and make sure we're safe. The NSA, the sort of global mass surveillance that's occurring in all of these countries, not just the U.S., and it's important to remember that this is a global issue, they're setting fire to the future of the internet. And the people who are in this room now, you guys are all the firefighters, and we need you to help us fix this.
So, Chris, you heard Ed say that the NSA offensive mass surveillance programs, the sort of manufacturing of vulnerabilities, is setting fire to the future of the internet. You want to comment on that?
Sure. So many of the communications tools that we all rely on are not as secure as they could be. Particularly for the apps and services that are made by small companies and small groups of developers, security is often an afterthought, if it's a thought at all. And really what that's done is enable global passive surveillance by the U.S., but other governments too. You know, what I think has been the most lasting impression for me from the last 8 months is the fact that the real technical problems that the NSA seems to have are not how do we get people's communications, but how do we deal with the massive amounts of communications data that we're collecting? The actual collection problem doesn't seem to be a bottleneck for the NSA, and that's because so many of the services that we're all relying on are not secure by default. And so I really think for this audience, one of the things that we should be thinking about and hopefully taking home is the fact that we need to lock things down. We need to make services secure out of the box, and that's going to require a rethink by developers. It's going to require that developers start to think about security early on rather than later on down the road.
Well, let me pick up on that. Ed, you submitted written testimony last week to the European Parliament, and I want to quote a very short part of that and have you elaborate on it. You said, in connection with mass surveillance, the good news is that there are solutions. The weakness of mass surveillance is that it can very easily be made much more expensive through changes in technical standards. What kinds of changes were you talking about, and how can we ensure that we make mass surveillance more expensive and less practical?
Right. So the primary challenge that mass surveillance faces from any agency, any government in the world, is not just how do you collect the communications as they cross the wires, as they sort of find their way through the global network, but how do you interpret them? How do you understand them? How do you break them back out and analyze them? And all of that is guarded, at least on the easiest, the simplest, and most cost-effective basis, by encryption. And there are two methods of encryption that are generally used, and one of which is deeply problematic. One of those is what's called key escrow. It's sort of what we're using with like Google-type services, Skype-type services right now, where I encrypt a video chat and I send it to Google. Google decrypts it and then re-encrypts it to you guys, and we have end-to-end encryption, where it's from my computer directly to your computer, makes mass surveillance impossible at the network level without a crypto break, and they're incredibly rare, and they normally don't work, and they're very expensive. By doing end-to-end encryption, you force what are called the threat model, global passive adversaries, to go for the endpoints, that is, the individual computers. And the result of that is a more constitutional, more carefully overseen sort of intelligence gathering model, law enforcement model, where if they want to gather somebody's communications, they have to target them specifically. They can't just target everybody all the time, and then when they want to read your stuff, they go back in the time machine and they say, what did they say, you know, in 2006? They can't pitch exploits at every computer in the world without getting caught. That's the value of end-to-end encryption, and that's what we need to be thinking about. We need to go, how can we enforce these protections in a simple, cheap, and effective way that's invisible to users? And I think that's the way to do it.
So, Chris, one of the obstacles to widespread end-to-end encryption is that many of us get our email service from advertising companies that need to be able to read the emails in order to serve us targeted ads. But what are steps that even a company like Google, that's an advertising company, or companies like that, can do to make mass surveillance more difficult? Are there things, or do we really need new business models to accomplish what Ed is talking about?
I mean, in the last 8 months, the big Silicon Valley technology companies have really improved their security in a way that was surprising to many of us who have been urging them for years to do so. You know, it really took Yahoo. Yahoo was kicking and screaming the whole way, but they finally turned on SSL encryption in January of this year after Bart Gellman and Ashkan Soltani shamed them on the front page of the Washington Post. The companies have locked things down, but only in a certain way. They've secured the connection between your computer and Google's server or Yahoo's server or Facebook's server, which means that governments have to now go through Google or Facebook or Microsoft to get your data instead of getting it with AT&T's help or Verizon's help or Comcast or any party that watches the data as it goes over the network. I think it's going to be difficult for these companies to offer a truly end-to-end encrypted service simply because it conflicts with their business model, right? Google wants to sit between you and everyone you interact with and provide some kind of added value, whether that added value is advertising or, you know, some kind of information mining, improved experience, telling you when there are restaurants nearby where you can meet your friends. They want to be in that connection with you, and that makes it difficult to secure those connections. But
is this the right time for a shout out to Google that is in this conversation with us right now?
So look, the irony that we're using Google Hangouts to talk to Ed Snowden has not been lost on me or our team here. And I should be clear, you know, we're not getting any advertising support from Google here. The fact is that the tools that exist to enable secure end-to-end encrypted video conferencing are not very polished. And particularly when you're having a conversation with someone who's in Russia and who's bouncing his connection through several proxies, the secure communications tools tend to break. And this, in fact, I think reflects the state of play with many services. You have to choose between a service that's easy to use and reliable and polished, or a tool that is highly secure and impossible for the average person to use. And I think that reflects the fact that the services that are developed by large companies with the resources to put 100 developers on the user interface, those are the ones that are not optimized for security, and the tools that are designed with security as the first goal are typically made by independent developers and activists and hobbyists, and they're typically tools made by geeks for geeks. And so what that means is the regular users have to pick. They have to pick between a service they cannot figure out how to use, or a service that is bundled with their phone or bundled with their laptop and works out of the box. And of course, rational people choose the insecure tools because they're the ones that come with the devices they buy and work and are easy for people to figure out.
Well, let's bring Ed back into this because, in a way, this whole affair began with Glenn Greenwald not being able to use PGP, which is somewhat of a joke in the tech community, but really not outside the tech community. PGP is not easy to install, and it's not easy to use. Using Tor, using Tails, you know, I feel like I need new IT support in my office just to be able to do this work. So, you know, you're addressing an audience that includes a lot of young technologists. Is there a call to arms for people to make this stuff more usable so that not only technologists can use it?
There is, and I think you're actually seeing a lot of progress being made here. Whisper systems, the sort of Moxie Marlin Spikes of the world, are focusing on new user experiences, new UIs, and basically ways for us to interact with cryptographic tools. And this is the way it should be, where it happens invisibly to the user. It happens by default, right? We want secure services that aren't opt-in. It's got to pass the Greenwald test. You know, if any journalist in the world gets an email from somebody saying, hey, I have something that the public might want to know about, they need to be able to open it. They need to be able to access that information. They need to be able to have those communications, whether they're a journalist or an activist or even your grandma. You know, this is something that people have to be able to access. And really the way we interact with it right now is not good. You know, if you have to go to the command line, people aren't going to use it. If you have to go three menus deep, people aren't going to use it. It has to be out there, it has to happen automatically, and it has to happen seamlessly. And that's within reach.
So who are we talking to, Chris? Are we talking now to technology companies? Are we talking to foundations to support the development of more usable security? Are we talking just to developers? Who's the audience for this call to arms?
I mean, I think the audience is everyone, but we should understand that most regular people are not going to go out and download an obscure encryption app. Most regular people are going to use the tools that they already have. That means they're going to be using Facebook or Google or Skype. And so a lot of our work goes into pressuring those companies to protect their users. In January of 2010, Google turned on SSL, the lock icon in your web browser. They turned it on by default for Gmail. It had previously been available, but it had been available through an obscure setting, the 13th of 13 configuration options, and of course no one turned it on. When Google turned that option on, suddenly they made passive bulk surveillance of their users' communications far more difficult for intelligence agencies. And they did so without requiring that their users take any steps. One day, their users just logged into their mail, and it was secure. And that's what we need. We need services to be building security in by default and enabled without any advanced configuration. Now, that doesn't mean that small developers cannot play a role. There are going to be, you know, hot new communications tools. Things, you know, WhatsApp basically came out of nowhere a few years ago, and what I want is for the next WhatsApp or the next Twitter to be using encrypted end-to-end communications. This can be made easy to use. This can be made usable, but you need to put a team of user experience developers on this. You need to optimize. You need to make it easy for the average person. And you know, if you're a startup and you're working on something, bear in mind that it's going to be more difficult for the incumbents to deliver secure communications to their users because their business models are built around advertising-supported services. You can more effectively and more easily deploy these services than they can. And so I think if you're looking for an angle here, I think we're slowly getting to the point where telling your customers, hey, $5 a month for encrypted communications, no one can watch you, I think that's something that many consumers might be willing to pay for.
So
if I could actually piggyback on that real quick, one of the things I want to say is for the larger company, it's not that you can't collect any data. It's that you should only collect the data and hold it for as long as necessary for the operation of the business. Recently, EC Council, one of the security certification providers, was hacked, and they actually stole my passport, a copy of my passport, my registration forms, and posted them to the internet when they could face the site. Now, I submitted those forms back in 2010. Why was that still on a web-facing server? Was it still necessary for the business? That's a good example of when these things need to age off. And whether you're Google or Facebook, you can do these things in a responsible way where you can still get the value out of these that you need to run your business for your ad support manager without putting your users in risk.
So we didn't have great audio here on that response, but what Ed was saying is that even companies whose business model relies on them to collect and aggregate data don't need to store it indefinitely once its primary use has been accomplished. His example was that some company was hacked and they found some of his data from 4 years ago that clearly there was no business reason for them still to be holding on to. Let's switch gears a little bit. Last week, Ed, General Keith Alexander, who heads the NSA, testified that he believes that the disclosures of the last 8 months have weakened the country's cyber defenses. Some people might think there's a pot and a kettle problem coming from him, but what was your response to that testimony?
So it's very interesting to see officials like Keith Alexander talking about damage that's been done to sort of the defense of our communications. Because more than anything, there have been two officials in America who have harmed our internet security and actually our national security, because so much of us, so much of our country's economic success is based on our intellectual property. It's based on our ability to create and share and communicate and compete. Now, those two officials are Michael Hayden and Keith Alexander, two directors of the National Security Agency in the post-9/11 era, who made a very specific change, and that is they elevated offensive operations, that is attacking, over the defense of our communications. They began eroding the protections of our communications in order to get an attacking advantage. Now, this is a problem for one primary reason, and that's America has more to lose than anyone else when every attack succeeds. When you are the country, the one country in the world who has sort of a vault that's more full than anyone else's, it doesn't make any sense for you to be attacking all day and never defending your full vault. And it makes even less sense when you set the standards for vaults worldwide to have a big back door that anybody can walk in through. And that's what we're running into today. So when he says, you know, these things have weakened national security, no, these are improving our national security. These are improving the communications not just of Americans, but everyone in the world, because we rely on the same standards. We rely on the ability to trust our communications. And without that, we don't have anything. Our economy cannot succeed.
So, Chris, Richard Clark testified a few weeks back that it's more important for us to be able to defend ourselves against attacks from China than to be able to attack China using our cyber tools. I don't think everybody understands that there's any tension whatsoever between those two goals. Why are they in opposition to each other?
As a country, we have public officials testifying in Washington saying that cybersecurity is the greatest threat this country now faces, greater than terrorism. We've had both the director of the FBI and the director of national intelligence say this in testimony to Congress. And I think it's probably true that we do, in fact, face some kind of a cybersecurity threat. I think that our systems are not as safe as they could be, and we are all vulnerable to compromise in one way or another. But what should be clear is that this government isn't really doing anything to keep us secure and safe. This is a government that has prioritized for offense rather than defense. You know, if there were a 100% increase in murders in Baltimore next year, the chief of police of Baltimore would be fired. If there is a 100% increase in phishing attacks, successful phishing attacks where people's credit card numbers get stolen, no one gets fired. As a country, we have basically been left to ourselves. Every individual person is left to defend themselves online, and the government has been hoarding information about information security vulnerabilities. In some cases, there was a disclosure in the New York Times or a report in the New York Times last fall revealing that NSA has been partnering with U.S. technology companies to intentionally weaken the security of the software that we all use and rely on. And so the government has really been prioritizing its efforts on information collection. And there is this fundamental conflict. There's a tension, which is that a system that is secure is difficult to surveil, and a system that is designed to be surveilled is a target waiting to be attacked. And our networks have been designed with surveillance in mind. We need to prioritize cybersecurity, and that's going to mean making surveillance more difficult. And of course, the NSA and their partners in the intelligence world are not crazy about us going down that path.
So Ed, if the NSA is willing to take these steps that actually weaken security, that spread vulnerabilities, that make it, in some sense, easier not just for us to do surveillance, but for others to attack, they must think there's an awfully good reason for doing that. That there are bulk collection programs that these activities facilitate, the collect-it-all mentality, that it really works. That this is a very, very effective surveillance method in keeping us safe. So, you know, you sat on the inside of these systems for longer than people realize. Do these mass surveillance programs do what our intelligence officials promised to Congress that they do? Are they effective?
They're not. That's actually something that I'm a little bit sympathetic to, because we've got to turn back the clock a little bit and remember that they thought this was a great idea, but no one had ever done it before, at least publicly. So they went, hey, we can spy on everybody in the world all at once. It'll be great. We'll know everything. But the reality is, when they did it, they found out it didn't work. But it was such a good story. It was so successful in securing funding. It was so great at getting new billets. It was so great at winning new contracts that nobody wanted to say no. But the reality is now, we've reached a point where the majority of Americans' telephone communications are being recorded. We've got all this metadata that's being stored for years and years and years. But two independent White House investigations have found it has no value at all. It's never helped us. Beyond that, we've got to think about what are we doing with those resources? What are we getting out of them? And as I said in my European Parliament testimony, we've actually had tremendous intelligence failures because we're monitoring the internet. We're monitoring, you know, everybody's communications instead of suspects' communications. And that lack of focus has caused us to miss leads that we should have had. Tamerlan Tsarnaev of the Boston bombers, the Russians had warned us about it, but we did a very poor FBI investigation. We didn't have the resources. We had people looking at other things. And if we hadn't spent so much on mass surveillance, if we followed the traditional models, we might have caught that. Umar Farouk Mubtalib, the underwear bomber, same thing. His father walked into a U.S. embassy. He went to a CIA officer. He said, my son is dangerous. Don't let him go to your country. Get him help. We didn't follow up. We didn't actually investigate this guy. We didn't dedicate a team to figure out what was going on because we spent all of this money. We spent all of this time hacking into Google and Facebook's backends to look at their database, their data center communications. What did we get out of that? We got nothing, and two White House investigations have confirmed that.
And that was NSA contractor turned whistleblower Edward Snowden addressing the crowd at the South by Southwest Festival in Austin, Texas, earlier today. You're listening to A Public Affair here on WORT 89.9 FM. I'm your host, Molly Stentz. Now, that audio, if you're wondering, Edward was communicating to the conference via video stream that was relayed through seven proxies for security purposes, meaning that that audio was leaving Russia and going around the world seven times before it got to Austin. So bear with us for the low quality of that audio feed, but we thought it was important and you would want to hear it. So now what can be done about the government surveillance that Edward Snowden was just discussing today? How does it affect us here in Wisconsin? Well, to unpack the state of surveillance here in our own backyard is one of our own privacy experts, Emilio De Torre. Emilio works with the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union of Wisconsin. He's out of the Milwaukee office, and he's the Youth and Program Director. Now, we have Emilio on the line from Milwaukee joining us today. Thanks for joining us, Emilio.
Thank you for having me, Molly.
So, tell us, in Wisconsin, if we are thinking, if we're listening to Edward Snowden, if we're concerned about the state of privacy and surveillance, all of these things, but feel like perhaps they're very far away, perhaps these are, you know, high profile figures that are being targeted, you know, heads of state, celebrities, journalists, folks with high profiles, if we feel that perhaps, you know, everyday folks that we're not affected, what would you say to folks like me and here in Madison and here in Wisconsin about how much surveillance we are subject to just as everyday folks living in the state of Wisconsin?
That's a great question, and that's come up a lot recently. So much of what Snowden refers to seems to be national, but it's not, and it plays out particularly in Madison and in Milwaukee. Just starting at the top, the aggregations of metadata, what information is being collected by the government, whose cell phones are being monitored, whose lines are being monitored, whose email is being acquired, that's an unknown. Nobody knows what that is right now. Then locally, you've got all sorts of intrusions. You've got license plate readers being employed by multiple cities in the state. You've got two fusion centers here in Wisconsin, which aggregates all sorts of metadata. In Milwaukee, you've got one called the Southeastern Wisconsin Terrorism Alert Center. And in Madison, you have one, the Wisconsin Statewide Intelligence Center. And scary enough that all of this data is being aggregated, it also incorporates private contractors along with federal government, military, and local law enforcement. So there's a big blurring of accountability. There's hard to follow lines of accountability. You're not sure who has access to this information. And then, of course, there are the ubiquitous CCTVs. I know Madison as well as Milwaukee both have cameras, and I believe Madison has audio recorders on their campus. And this is, you know, you're not certain when you're being recorded, who has access to this information, what are the retention and destruction policies regarding this information, do you need a warrant to access this information, what are your privacy ramifications. So there's a lot of ways that electronics and technology are encroaching upon privacy.
So you've just laid out a whole laundry list of ways in which we are being watched, we're being tracked, we're being surveilled here by local governments along with state governments, private contractors. What's the danger of that? What's the danger of all of these government agencies having this data? As you mentioned, the surveillance cameras that are everywhere. They're on State Street. They're downtown here in Madison. You mentioned they're in Milwaukee as well. What's the danger with our every movement being recorded and captured?
Well, even just viewing it as from multiple perspectives, is there a danger for being monitored? Are there opportunities for folks to track and jump to conclusions? I mean, one example of that popped up a couple of years ago from the Wisconsin Statewide Info Center, where they employ many, many different people to sift through this information. And it then comes to the determining of who gets flagged as a danger by monitoring where you're going. So one of these reviewers labeled as a potential terrorist that threat the anti-abortion protesters who demonstrated at a UW Regents meeting. You've got opportunities to compile and stack this data over the course of who knows how long, because we don't know all of the information that's being measured or where it's done. So you have an opportunity for not only just danger, but your secrets getting out. And there's an example that National ACLU specialist on privacy rights, Jay Stanley, gives of a teen girl, having her web search identified and looking into the address bar of her email as she saves coupons for Pampers and birthdays and, you know, cute little things to design a room for. And so now Target knows and is identifying her as somebody who's pregnant even before she's had an opportunity to share this information with her parents. If you get a chance to Google Meet Jack, ACLU Meet Jack, you'll see a hypothetical example that's really well laid out of how local law enforcement can monitor your whereabouts through CCTVs, through tracking you, vehicle trip overlays of where you're going, what you're doing, and the various outcomes that can come from that. So if I want to increase the amount of time I'm surveilling you for whatever reason, maybe you're a union organizer, or maybe you are running against a certain sheriff where you are contradicting publicly an elected official, now I can track your actions and potentially put more emphasis on you to get you pulled over or arrested. So I think there are a lot of ways you can take a look at this. The fact that I can read your address bar, you know, maybe I can see that you're contacting a local AIDS resource center and your doctor or an HIV clinic and put two and two together and come up with a potential sum that you have AIDS. So I think that there are, we can extrapolate dangers all day long, and they get pretty scary.
Sure. Just hearing you list all of the various ways and doing some more research, it's enough to make you not want to do anything online. As I'm sitting here with my laptop on an open wireless network using a Gmail account.
it always brings to mind the song "Somebody's Watching You."
Yeah, and I noticed in your email you have a little tagline at the bottom, warning, NSA analysts could be reading this email, and because there's hardly any accountability, we have no idea how they may use it. If that bothers you, click here. So what are some of the things that the ACLU is doing to address this issue?
Well, there are a variety of things, and I won't get into any of the national issues, which I'm sure your listeners just heard through this great interview with Eric Snowden. But locally, it's really important for folks to put some accountability on their local officials. We have two fusion centers here. Part of the funding, at least, comes up locally. There's their request for funding here. Individuals need to hold their local elected accountable for this. Who has access to the video records that are taken? How can I access this? What are the retention destruction policies? What is the protocol for private institutions getting a hold of these documents? Because very frequently, records that are used or compiled by the federal government, at least, can sometimes be sold off and shared with commercial entities. And is that something that local Joe and Jane, Wisconsin, know about? Are we able to contact our local officials and have them know the answers? Because they may not know. That old Franklin adage about giving up some freedoms for security, but there are far longer-lasting ramifications for this now, since these records are held and then transferred. I think those are a couple of big ways. Even if parents or folks have been used to using the excuse, I don't understand Facebook, I'm not on it, I don't get Twitter, I don't know. We're still using credit cards, we're still using cell phones, and lack of knowledge isn't an excuse any longer. Folks need to get informed somehow, and certainly there are some introductions to this available on our website and also on YouTube.
Yeah, that was one of the themes of the conversation between the ACLU technologist and Edward Snowden that we heard earlier today at South by Southwest. He said, you know, it's often that the public has to choose between insecure tools and ones that are easy to use. So the free and ubiquitous tools, things like Gmail, versus ones that actually protect your privacy. And inevitably, the public picks ones that are easier to use, and it's not what do you do with that? How do consumers become more involved and learn about their data and learn about their privacy rights and learn about, there's so many kinds of technology to keep up with, so many apps, so many programs. How do you advise people to keep up?
You've hit a big challenge. In as much as the law and our policies are having difficulties keeping up with the technological advancement, we as consumers are having difficulties keeping up with technological advancement. And some of that is a greater emphasis on either doing the homework ourselves or going to a trusted source to get that information. The UW system, for example, has a lot of talent in there who speak about privacy rights and technology. For example, UW-Madison has Dorothy Asallo, who works for the Library Association, who's got a lot on that. UW-Milwaukee has Professor Michael Zimmer, who has a lot on this. Some of it means just doing homework. Just because it has an attractive graphic user interface doesn't mean it's the best thing. So you can use DuckDuckGo as a search engine instead of Google, because they're not going to be saving all of your search records and having it out there for consumers. You have to give specific permissions. And the same thing goes to different add-ons for your internet browser or using secure protocols or just taking the time out to have somebody that you trust go over your cell phone and make sure that you're using the most secure way to use Bluetooth or get on the internet. There is a lot of homework, and really there's no answer for that. If you don't have the luxury of being able to do that research yourself, and if there's too big a learning curve, then you're going to have to reach out to a trusted website or an individual and have them help you a little bit, at least just to get the essentials down.
And that's what we're trying to do a little bit here, trying to bring these conversations to the public and engage people on these issues of government surveillance and of privacy and of civil liberties. And today we're speaking with Emilio De Torre from the ACLU of Wisconsin, joining us from the Milwaukee office. And we do actually have a caller on the line that wants to join our conversation and ask a question about civil liberties, privacy, government surveillance. So we will go to the phone lines and take that caller. And please share with us your first name and your question.
Yeah, this is John. The state of Orwellian insanity that exists in this country has gotten to the point of absurdity. It's the Senate Oversight Committee on Intelligence complained that their correspondence with each other was being monitored by the NSA. What I would really like to know is, in view of the president's own committee that said it had to be, the metadata collection had to stop, we've had federal judges for and against it. I'd like to know where we are now, because the way it stands with this metadata collection, there is no freedom of the press. They can't be secure in their sources anymore. You can follow everything that a reporter does, every communication he has. It constrains the individual's democratic expression of political opinions, because none of us know what's going to be traitorous to one side or the other or what is seditious. There's no probable cause anymore. And the most important thing, which has happened here, and I've seen it from people calling to this show and all over the place, is people no longer trust that their communications are safe. Our Fourth Amendment guarantee to be secure in our letters has been broken. I want to know where we are in metadata collection by the NSA.
All right, John, thanks for the call and the important question. Now, Emilio, I know that you are not the legal counsel for the ACLU, but do you have an...
Sure. I think that the caller had a great question. And I can speak broadly to it. Obviously, there was the national lawsuit, the ACLU versus Clapper, that's a challenge to the NSA mass call tracking program. Where that is right now and where we are as a country with metadata, you know, the caller hit the nail on the head. Even the elected officials don't know. They're being surveilled. You have international incidents like Merkel from Germany having the embarrassment of accusing the United States of tracking her private cell phone. And it is Orwellian, and it is very frightening. The privacy of beliefs, privacy of home, your personal possessions, all of this is definitely threatened by the policies that are going forward right now. And I can't answer you clearly to tell you where we are specifically, except to encourage you to believe that the tracking of the data is probably not stopped.
Well, and we are seeing more and more heat about the subject. Now you have Senator Rand Paul filing a lawsuit against the NSA just a few weeks ago, along with FreedomWorks, a conservative organization. So there's political actors getting in the game, filing lawsuits. You guys, the ACLU has filed a lawsuit. So there are several legal challenges pending. Of course, the courts have been split on the matter thus far about whether it is legal or constitutional. So that's still playing out. But through your work here, have you witnessed that this attention that has been generated by Edward Snowden and The Guardian, has this resulted in actually more public opinion? Are you hearing from more people here at your office that are now interested in these issues? Or is it not really?
A little both. I think that more people are connecting the dots between what Snowden is exposing and what's going on locally. So certainly there's been an increase in attention toward the Wisconsin Fusion Centers, for example. There's been an increase in concern over who is monitoring all of the cameras that are being put up around Wisconsin and what is done with that information. Are folks going to be putting this online, and what does this mean to my privacy? So I really do believe people are connecting the dots between a kind of a global surveillance that makes our most intimate actions able to come under public scrutiny. And the fact that there are a few lines of accountability makes it all the more scary.
And so the ACLU uses primarily legal strategies to, you know, lawsuits often, to fight. Do you feel that there are other strategies that your organization uses, or is that the primary way to fight it in the courts?
Well, Molly, that's one of the biggest ways, and that's certainly sadly proven the most effective way over and over again to fight it in the courts. We rely a lot on public education also. An informed public is a strong public. And there are a couple of good things that have been circulating for years. So if your listeners would Google, for example, ACLU PISA, you'll see a very funny yet frightening example of how public and private, you know, governmental and private institutions can use the data that are swept up through this, through sweeping or monitoring your online usage in a way that's both serious, frightening, and silly. Public education is huge. I mean, Wisconsin was the first affiliate to use both Facebook and Twitter, and that is a really important way for listeners and individuals around the state to be connected in what's a quickly shifting arena of information. So I think that there are multiple ways for folks to fight this, not the least of which is to be informed, to take precautions to protect yourself, and to contact those who are responsible for the laws of governance. Let them know of your opinion.
All right. Well, we have quickly approach the end of the hour here on A Public Affair. I've been speaking with Emilio DeTore of the ACLU of Wisconsin, speaking to us from the Milwaukee office. Thank you so much for joining us today, Emilio.
Thank you too, Molly.
Sure. Any good resources or any shout-outs that you would direct people toward?
I just encourage folks to keep up. Mashable is certainly good for some of this and CNET. And a shameless plug, our big annual fundraiser, the Bill of Rights Celebration, is coming up this Wednesday, and it's all about censorship and privacy. It's a libretto by Allen Ginsberg, set to the music of Philip Glass. So come on out.
So a great way to learn more about these issues. I also want to mention that if you're interested in hearing more, the full extended Q&A with Edward Snowden today at South by Southwest, it's available on their website, SXSW, so SouthbySouthwest.com. And you can find Edward Snowden's talk, as well as Julian Assange of WikiLeaks' talk, as well as Barton Gellman of the Washington Post and many other notable journalists and advocates that have been speaking out about national surveillance and privacy. So this brings us to the end of the hour here on A Public Affair. I've been your host, Molly Stentz, today, sitting in for John Quinlan, who hopefully will be back with us next week.